Would you introduce yourself, please?
My name is, to tell the truth, Cody Lee. I'm a musician, born and raised in New York, and I live in Chicago right now.
New York City, Vermont, UK, Boston. Yeah, so there's Boston, then there was New York again, then there was Champaign, then there was Chicago. There were syncs for video and TV, and then there's this album, this woodpecker thing today.
I would love to talk about art. The art of music, the art of songwriting. And then after that, I'd love to talk about music from a fan point of view, you know, somebody who listens. When I was a child, my first introduction, other than listening or going to Central Park to hear shows, was through a long story. I was in 10th grade helping this rock writer by the name of Lillian Roxon write her book. And so I would sneak out at night and, you know, I would go to Max's Kansas City, and Lillian was like the doyenne. So she'd have the big round table at the back of the house, and I'd be sitting there in 10th grade, and the next morning I go to school and I'm getting yelled at by some teacher, and I'm going, but I sat next to Lou Reed, Iggy Pop, and Alice Cooper last night, so I don't really care.
You found that over the years, I'm guessing, that most people really don't want to talk about the art of music or go deep to any great extent, or their version of it is something that is just kind of at the very least, a diluted color, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, it's influences and, you know, things like that. And we all have our favorites. And, you know, maybe it comes up in the course of conversation. But if I was sitting in a bar, I wouldn't go, you know, I really love Ray Davies. You know what I mean?
Goddard College was this hippy dippy school.
It was a great place. And that's where I met Peter Green. He became an artist in residence with, or really was just hanging out with those blues guys, the blues clique. And, he came in my college room one day when I was practicing bass. I used to be a bassist. And I swear this is the truth. Of all the British guitar players of that time, back when I was just explaining to somebody today, when British blues was indie rock, he was the only one that really, you know, really got to me. And I was aware he was on campus, but I was somewhere between way too shy and too phony cool to ever go near him. And when I'm playing bass and he walks in and he borrowed a Japanese guitar back when they weren't any good from the guy across the hall, sat down, started playing. 4 hours later, we had yet to say a word and we'd been playing for 4 hours.
And then there was Mississippi Fred McDowell in the mix.
And the education for me there was, he basically, I don't know how much guitar music you know, but he stays on the one chord and just kind of implies the five chord. And he never plays the four chord. So I had to learn how to keep each song interesting, not get in the way of what he was doing. And so every day we would come on stage, I came on stage with a glass of water, a bottle of water. And remember when the orange juice came in the glass bottles? He would come in with a glass bottle of water. Well, one day I knocked my glass over, so I poured some of his water in my glass, because even though he usually drank the whole bottle of water a night, it was not water. It was gin. And I'm going, and I get in a car with this guy driving at the end of the night.
And Berkeley, I know you didn't stay the whole time. And my guess is because you didn't subscribe to the Berkeley way.
Yes, completely. I literally, when I left Berkeley, I had to join an African-American gospel group in Roxbury and an African-American funk band. I lost my ear. I had been always able to pick up changes, you know, except for maybe a Steely Dan song. I could, you know, just go through a song. And by the time I left Berkeley, the math of music had totally fried me. And so then I went through this weird phase where I didn't talk to white folk for about 2-3 years during that, because I was always about whatever I was into, it was about keeping it real.
Right.
And then I moved back to New York, and I was still doing only speaking with black folk and hanging with black folk. And I realized, wow, this is an oppressive lifestyle, and I actually have a choice. And we had an incident that's not dissimilar to things you see in the news happened with the police. And it wasn't nearly as horrific, but it was in that flavor. And I saw an ad in the Village Voice, you know, band with label deal looking for bass player. And Andy Chernoff, the songwriter, was the original bass player on the first album, but I'm sure he's very, very good now, but back then he was, his timing and everything was weak. So they're going to move Andy to third guitar and keyboard and let Andy go ahead with writing the songs. So I spent a year in the band. So this is a good story, what happened to me. Okay, this is going to be, you're going to get a scoop. No one may care about this, but you're going to get it. I turned them down because they weren't very good. And they were also auditioning drummers at the time. And I made up an excuse because I was a polite young boy from New York. I said, you know, I'd love to join him, but I'm doing $400 to $500 a week in sessions, which was about a double. You know, I was maybe picking up 100 here, 200, you know. Yeah. So the next day I get a call from their road manager, Steve, and he says, okay, Sandy and Murray talked. Here's the deal. You'll be a full member. You get a salary, but you must, and we'll get your rent. But you must never tell anybody in the band that you're getting paid, ever.
Right.
So I did a year in the band, and I'll tell you how we got to Cody at that point too. But what happened was I was about keeping it real. So this is the nascent days of the punk rock scene. And I was downtown. I was getting high. I was dating naughty women and getting pretty dissolute. Then I come to discover that the rest of the damn band is going home to their mommies and daddies in Co-op City.
Right.
And I felt like, wow, I'm on the edge here. And we were not a good band. We were just not a good band. If we didn't rehearse it, the new drummer we got, Richie Teeter, who sadly has passed away, was very good. So Richie and I gave a good rhythm section. And Scott was always strong on rhythm, top 10. Anyway, but a year, we did one gig in that whole year. It was Rod Swenson's Miss All Bear America. And all we did was play like a Chuck Berry version of God, America the Beautiful. Wow. We came up on a riser. And my politics were such that, you know, I tried not to look at the girls who were walking around naked in high heels. Fool that I was back then.
Right.
And I spent a year in the band and I was getting pretty dissipated. And I realized like, you know, we weren't doing anything. And then after a year in the band, Epic had dropped the band and they didn't have a new label yet. And I've seen Scott refer to me in a bio as some hippie we had in the band for 2 weeks. No, I was in the band for a year.
Let's hit Falconetti, because that was probably the closest to being something, right?
Like a lot of young bands, we were very good, but so in desperate need of you know, a professional guidance, both in the studio and business-wise. And we always had managers, and we always often had a salary, and we always had a crew, but they weren't good managers. They wanted to be rock stars when they wanted to work a band. And right. So we never got in the studio with producers who could have improved our game.
Right.
I go back and I listen, and you know what? We had three guys that were the core of the band, and during many periods of the band, we gigged as a three-piece. I was a bass player back then still. We all sang. We all sang pretty well. We had cool songs. We were sort of this Kinksy, Stonesy, Mick Ronson, David Bowie hybrid. It was kind of cool. You know, but there wasn't anybody to tell us, you know, like, okay, you know. And we just didn't have any real guidance. And then, sadly, one of the guys in the band was prone to substance issues and, you know, I just felt like, I think I did 6-7 years in that band, and it was the one that, you know, was popular. We could put some bodies in the bars and clubs, but you just realize, wow, maybe it was 5 years, whatever it was, you know, we're banging our heads. It just isn't going anywhere. We hit that moment when all of our peer bands were cutting their hair and doing Elvis Costello imitations, because that was that moment. And none of us, we all liked Elvis Costello, but we didn't feel we could do that kind of shift and be who we were.
Now we're just going to time travel really, really, really fast. You've made a bevy of solo records, and this one seems to be the one that is resonating.
Well, let me tell you about the story. So years ago, in New York City, I was still working at SIR. Oh, when I quit the Dictators, before I quit, I went to Mike Johnson, the owner of the New York store, and I said, hey, can I get a job here? He said, yeah, sure. So then I went and said, I'm out. I was getting too high, too weird. Anyway, so this guy I also joined for the only time in my life what they call a GB gig, a general business. You show up with a fake book and you play in, you know, swanky rooms, and you know, you play The Shadow of Your Smile or Creedence Clearwater if they want that, or Gladys Knight, whatever they want, you play.
Right.
And Kurt was the guitar player. The drummer, Dave, as is Lenny Kaye's drummer when he plays without Patti Smith, and he was with Frank Carrillo and
that whole gang. Yep.
Yeah, Philip Rambeau. So anyway. But we were like these rock guys playing it, and the leader of the band was this trumpet player who was, his real name was Bill Hagen, but he was the last vibration of when it Latin thing, so he was El Diablo. Right. And then his wife was the Susan Alexander Citizen Kane. She wore a sprayed on outfit. I mean, sprayed on, and she had the body for that. But she sang, she made Susan Alexander sound like an opera singer.
How funny.
And so anyway, long story short, I could only, even though I was making real money, I quit because I think it was good for, you know, I think I did about 6 months and I had no self-respect left. So anyway, I quit. And then Kurt calls and says, I'm getting divorced. Can I stay with you? And I was staying at this converted hotel on the Upper West Side, Breton Hall on 86 and Broadway. And I said, sure.
Right.
And then through the miracle of the internet, I have a website, and I guess I had some malfunction when you hit send an email from the website.
Oh, Kurt right. Eger.
Eger, I know that name.
Oh, wow.
And it was already 6 months old.
Wow.
And anyway, we reconnected. He's been living down there playing music, doing commercials, but doing a day job some of the time. And he said, send me what you're doing. I'd love to hear what you're doing. So I sent him a song, and he said, do you mind if I mess with it? I said, no. And the first song was the fifth song on the record called Drowning. And he sent it back to me. And I said to Marcy, this is really cool. This guy's in my head. So he said, send me one more. And I sent him the second song on the record, which is a pretty song. And he did the same thing again.
Next thing you know.
Yeah. And so by the third time we did this after that, I said, look, Kurt, do you want to produce this thing? He said, yeah. And so that's what we obviously our friendship renewed, and he's been doing it. And we're already started. I think going forward, I'll release a track at a time, but I'm going to record three or four and pick the best one. So we've just finished, I think, about our third or fourth one. You know, for me, the art part is that even in the shabby world of rock and roll, is you're trying to get rid of all artifice. You're right. Trying to be as pure you, direct, honest, and I got in that zone for the whole record, and I think that's why it resonates.
That's hard work.
It really is. I mean, not bad hard work, but you know, your mind wants to get in the way. And finally, one day I was listening to Neil Young, and I said, you know, listen, they didn't even let him sing his songs on the first Buffalo Springfield record, and that didn't stop him. You know, he just. And then I started going, well, whether it's Neil Young or Bob Dylan or Mark Knopfler or Ian Hunter or any of these guys, they sing their songs. And that's when I realized I don't have to do anything but sing my songs. And that regardless of what has happened in the past with me in terms of success in the industry, I have a bunch of good songs in my back catalog, but this is a really cool record with good songs. Kurt and I, without what I love is that we didn't at all ever have any discussions about we want to be now sound.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside and then songs by others in between.